Thanks for coming. We got a nice number of people here today. Or like everybody says these days, a ton of people. So in Ralph's absence, I will attempt to give the blessing and join me. Our Father, we thank you for this day. We thank you for this gathering, this knowledge that will be imparted to us. We ask that you bless the food we are about to partake and keep us in your watch and your care. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, we've spared no cost to get our speaker here today. His name, Chris Schlieder.
Very good.
Chris was born in Washington, D.C. and grew up in the Maryland suburbs. As a child, he was fascinated by what passed for technology in the 1960s and 70s, especially radio. He graduated from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill with a degree in radio, television, and motion pictures, but he soon realized that if he really wanted to make a living, he needed to shift disciplines. He completed a master's degree in computer science in 1981, kind of ahead of his time, and worked as a technology manager for the UNC Athletic Department for 15 years. In 1996, he had the chance to be the results manager for baseball for the Atlanta Olympics, and in 1996, left UNC to pursue his new dream. The Atlanta job led to a job as a sports planning results manager for the Sydney 2000 Olympic Games, which led to a results manager job for the Salt Lake 2002 Winter Games. Talk about networking. After a year as a technology consultant for the Athens 2004 Olympic Games, he became the on-site project manager for timing, scoring, and results for Swiss Timing for the Torino 2006 and Vancouver 2010 Winter Games. He was also the Swiss Timing venue manager for baseball and softball for the Athens 2004 and Beijing 2008 Olympics. He retired to St. George in 2006, but continues to work on the Paralympic Games as a results technology consultant. So I'm proud to introduce Chris.
Thank you. Hold your applause to the end. This is going to be long. There are 67 slides in this deck. Some of them won't take but about 5 seconds, but some of them are going to take a couple of minutes. So I understand if you need to leave, get up and leave. I won't be offended. I know I'm a little bit long-winded. Just a quick aside on what Alicia just told you. I started this whole journey back in 1970 when I was a sophomore in high school and wanted to be a pitcher on the baseball team. And I got sick during tryouts, and I went in to see the coach when I got back, and he said, "I don't see you making the team as a pitcher." And I said, "Well, is there some way I can contribute?" And he said, "How would you like to be our manager?" So I said, "What's a manager do?" He says, "Well, you'll help me prepare the field. You'll keep score. You'll be in charge of making sure the equipment gets to all the games as we go." I said, "That sounds like fun." So I was the head baseball manager my sophomore year. I was the head baseball and head football manager my junior and senior years, and got a job as a football manager at North Carolina, which led to Atlanta, which led to Sydney, which led to Salt Lake, which led to Athens, dot, dot, dot. And I decided in 2002, we came down for a golf weekend, that I really liked St. George. So when I finished in Torino, I retired here. I didn't really retire. I went and worked Vancouver, but same thing. So because I didn't make the baseball team in 1970, I'm standing here with you today. So life takes a meandering route, but I think all of us can probably trace back to one event in our lives that has probably more than anything else affected what we became and where we are. All right, we're going to talk today about online safety, but we're going to talk about a few other things other than just online safety. Couple of basic facts to start with, if I can get the button to work. There it is. There is no way to be 100% safe in life. I think we all agree with that. You get in the car, you could get run over by a semi. There's also no way to be 100% safe online. Gordon. Yeah, you can. it'll just prolong it. I've got a question section at the end, but if you have questions, ask them, because it may be more useful to do it in context than to try to do it at the end. So there is no way to be 100% safe online. Regardless of what you do, you're at risk. There are ways to mitigate some of those risks, but keeping yourself safe online is your responsibility. Nobody is going to do it for you. Major areas of concern: passwords and authentication, and we're going to talk a lot about passwords. Fraud: we're going to talk a lot about fraud, and we have a few people here who can speak to this. And we're going to talk about public Wi-Fi. There are things everyone should do. Use strong passwords, and we'll talk about what those are in a minute. Enable two-factor authentication on websites if they offer it. And that's particularly true of banks and financial institutions. Keep all of your software up to date, particularly your antivirus software. Use trusted antivirus software, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. And be careful what you share online, particularly on social media. If you're going on vacation, it is probably not a great idea to put a post on your Facebook page that says, "Hey, I'm going to be gone for 3 weeks." Because people do look at your Facebook page. You don't know who they are. They see that. If they know where you live, chances are real good there's going to be an issue. So be careful with what you share online. Talk a little bit about passwords and authentication. For the foreseeable future, passwords are a fact of life. There are ways around passwords now, but they're still the predominant way of identifying that you are who you say you are. They're probably the least effective security measure you can take, because passwords are not hard to crack. And even strong passwords, and we're going to talk about strong passwords in a minute, can be guessed, most of them. What are the world's most popular passwords?
1, 2, 3, 4.
That's one of them.
Address.
No password at all. Yep. Believe it or not, a lot of people will change the default password that they get to nothing. Most sites won't let you do that now, but they used to. Password, all lowercase. Password, mixed case. 1, 2, 3, 4. Birthdays, particularly yours. Names. No, almost nobody uses their social security number anymore. I think we've finally gotten that message through to them. Plus the fact most people don't know what their social security number is. A lot of people do, a lot of people don't. So what makes a strong password? At least 12 characters, and longer than that is better. And I will be the first to admit I have some 5 and 6 character passwords floating around, but the ones that I have floating around that are that short are all passwords for sites that if somebody breaks in, I really don't care. It's not going to matter. Use numbers, upper and lowercase characters, or letters and special characters. Make sure it's easy to remember so you don't forget it. And type, and we're going to talk a little about that later, and make it hard to guess. There's nothing wrong with using a phrase as your password. It generally can't have spaces in it. It generally has a limit on which special characters you can use. But you can use a phrase of 20, 30, 40 characters. The site doesn't care, but remember, you're going to have to type it every time you go to that site, so you might want to be careful. Anne?
How about you use something like
Keeper? Well, we're going to talk about password managers in a minute, too. Do not use as your whole password your name, or the name of your spouse, if you have one, or the name of your children, if you have them. Those are readily available names that anybody could guess. Your street number, your birthday, your mother's maiden name, which is particularly critical because a lot of sites use that as a secondary check. If you forget your password, they're going to want to know your mother's maiden name. Well, if I put my mother's maiden name as my password and somebody guesses it, they can go change it because they know what my mother's maiden name is. Your Social Security number, your Medicare ID number. So don't use anything that's real, for lack of a better word. How long do you think it would take somebody to crack, say, an 8-letter all-number password? Yes? Anybody? 1 millisecond. How long do you think it would take someone to crack an 18-character password with letters, numbers, upper and lowercase letters, numbers, and special characters? longer than the length of the life of the universe. Here's a chart that shows by the number of characters and the type of characters how long it would take a hacker to hack your password. So if you use an 8-character password, which is pretty much what everybody has been taught to use, they can if it's numbers only, they can do it instantly. It takes about a millisecond. Lowercase letters take about 5 seconds because there are 26 possibilities for each letter. Upper and lowercase takes about 20 minutes. Numbers upper and lowercase characters takes about an hour. And numbers upper and lowercase letters and symbols takes about 8 hours. Now keep in mind, this is with current computing capabilities. If we ever get to quantum computers, this is all off the table. Everything up there will take less than a second. Yeah. You might have heard that LastPass was recently hacked. I use LastPass for my password manager. Was recently hacked, and the hackers were able to download actual password vaults from about 83 million people. The fear is because they're now offline that they can sit there and attack them with generated passwords basically forever. Mine was one of the ones that was downloaded. I'm not the least bit worried. My password for LastPass is 20 characters long. It is random characters, it's not words. It has numbers, upper and lowercase letters, and special characters. And if it takes 7 quadrillion years to crack an 18-character password, it takes about 30 quadrillion years to break a 20-character password. They are never going to break into my password vault. So that's why we say longer is better. If you look at a 12-character password, upper and lowercase letters takes about 300 years. That's acceptable to me. I don't think my passwords are going to be around in 300 years. I'm certainly not going to be around in 300 years. But if you used just numbers, it takes about 20 seconds. So long, long, complex passwords are what you want to use. Use different passwords for each website. Nobody does. I don't. I have probably 20 sites that use the same password. If you have a password manager, it will actually look through all of your passwords and tell you where you've reused them. But it isn't worth it to me for most of the sites that I visit to be worried about it. The question then is, how do I remember all those passwords? I don't remember why I just walked into the room I'm in. Use a password manager. They store all your passwords. They have a password generator, but I'll warn you, the password generator generates random characters, so it is nearly impossible to remember those passwords if you ever need to. It uses a single master password to access all of your passwords, like my LastPass password, and it can automatically fill in login screens on computers, phones, and tablets. It is a lot better on computers than it is on phones and tablets, but it will work. If you use a password manager, be sure your master password is long and complex. 15 characters or longer and complex, so you use all the different types of characters. Anne's counting how many characters are in her keeper password. Yeah, you're right. Well, let's go back. 13 characters, is it complex?
Numbers, upper, lower, and other letters.
Okay, 2 million years.
And I don't have special
Those are the other letters. Special characters are things like dollar signs and ampersands and that kind of thing. So 2 million years to crack your keeper password. I wouldn't worry about it even if they steal it. And change your passwords often. Because the chances are good that if somebody figures out one of them, you're going to need to change it, but you may need to change others that are related to it. Other means of authentication, biometric. If you have a phone, you've probably used your fingerprint or your face to unlock your phone. You can do the same thing with some websites. You can use an online authenticator. How many people do we have here who worked back in the 90s? How many people do we have here who used a secure ID key fob or a secure ID device? I figured you would. It's the same thing, it's just they do it on your phone now and you don't have to carry something around with you. Or two-factor authentication. All right, biometrics are generally used for mobile devices. If you have a webcam on your computer, on your laptop, you can use it there, but biometrics are better for the for mobile devices. It uses the camera to scan your face, or it uses a fingerprint sensor or something of that ilk to verify that you are who you say you are. Online authenticators are apps that are produced by Google, Adobe, Microsoft. There are probably 20 of them out there that are basically like the old secure ID, except that it's an app on your phone rather than carrying around a device. Some apps and websites require them. Adobe Acrobat every once in a while will require you to go to Authenticator and authenticate yourself before you can log in. Microsoft Teams requires it almost every time you log in, which is one of the reasons I'm not a fan of Teams. And some don't support them at all. So I'm not a big fan of online authenticators, but if you have to have one, they do work. And the last one is two-factor authentication. If you can turn it on a site, do so. What happens is the app says, we need to verify your identity. We will send you a code. Do you want it by email or do you want it on your phone? So you choose which one, and you either get an email or you get a pop-up message or a text with a code in it that you then enter into the website. It says, hey, you're who you say you are. I'm going to let you in. Most apps and websites support some form of it. Strangely enough, some banks don't. Chase does not, for example, does not have two-factor authentication, which annoys me because I really like two-factor authentication. It's an extra step, but it's a lot more secure. The only downside is if somebody's hacked your phone, they can actually get a hold of your SMSs too. So if the app or website supports it, turn it on. It'll be a pain, but turn it on. Let's talk a little bit about fraud. And we have some people in this room right now, notably our fearless leader back there in the teal sweater, who have participated in this in the past. And we're going to look at some of that. We're going to talk about phishing. We're going to talk about Trojans. And we're going to talk about ransomware. I'm sure everybody's heard about ransomware. It's where they get access to your computer and they encrypt all your data. And until you pay them, they will not give you the key to unencrypt your data. There are ways around it. Let's get one thing out of the way before we start. Ralph Klingon does not sign anything Reverend Dr. Ralph Klingon or variations of that. In fact, he usually doesn't sign anything at all. He ends all of his stuff with blessings. So if your text is from the Reverend Dr. Ralph Klingon, it's a scam. Right, Alicia? Yeah. Yeah, I hadn't seen that one. I get the Ralph ones every once in a while, and I'll tell you where they originate. Most of these come from Nigeria. How do I know that? Because I monitor which IP addresses look at our website on a regular basis, and of course, all of our names are out on the website. If you know how to get to them, most of our phone numbers are out on the website, those of us who are in leadership positions. And about once every 6 weeks, I guess, I will see an uptick in sites in people in Nigeria accessing the website. And within 24 hours, there are generally scam texts and things floating around. So anyway, there's nothing we can do about it. It's a fact of life. Just be careful of it. What is phishing? It's the fraudulent practice of sending emails or other messages purporting to be from reputable companies or people. Well, I guess Ralph's reputable. In order to induce individuals to reveal personal information such as passwords and credit card numbers. Examples of phishing scams, online shopping. Pay yourself. I've never actually seen that one, but I've heard about it. The famous grandparent scam. Tech support scams. Utility shutoff scams, and romance scams. And there is any way you can think of that somebody's found a way to make money off of you, they've tried it. Online shopping scams, a scammer sets up a fake online store and asks you to pay in ways other than a credit or debit card, which leaves you with no recourse if the item doesn't arrive. Generally, they want you to pay with a gift card. pay yourself. A text message that looks like it's from your bank says there's been suspicious activity on your account, and the only way to stop it is for you to send yourself a payment from Zelle. Except yourself is an interesting term because that's not who they want you to send it to. Grandparent scams. Someone impersonates a loved one in crisis, like claiming their car broke down or they lost their wallet and they need money right away. Yeah, that too. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that one. Tech support. A scammer requests access to your device to fix a technical issue, but really they're collecting personal information. Microsoft will never send you a text and say your computer is infected, nor will they send you an email. No reputable company will do that. They don't monitor your machine. They don't know if it has a virus. It's not their problem. It's yours. So if you get anything like that, it's a scam. Utility shutoff. A person poses as a utility employee saying that your service will be stopped unless you pay them. This is not as common now as it was a year and a half ago during COVID. There were a lot of these floating around back in 2020 and 2021. And a romance scam. Scammer creates a fake profile to gain your trust, then asks for money for a health crisis or other bogus scheme. Let's look at some examples. This is an email that I got a couple of months ago, actually back in October, from Reverend Dr. Ralph Klingon, pastor at pastor.office2320@gmail.com. Who knows what Ralph's email address is? It's revralph1@msn.com. This obviously didn't come from Ralph. He sent it to newsletter, which means I got it and the office got it. He isn't going to start with good day. I believe I can trust you, ? With a space before the question mark. I'm hoping you could help me with some gifts regarding some of our staff. Right. Well, I would like to know what you think as I await your reply to my email. He has never he has written sentences like that. They're usually more complicated than that. Blessings, comma, Reverend Dr. Ralph Klingon. He never, ever, ever, ever signs his name like that. So what are the key things you want to look at in this email? Look at this. If this email address doesn't match what you know his email address to be, throw the email away. If the text doesn't make sense to you, throw the email away. Okay? You've got to watch these things because if you're in a hurry and you're not paying attention, you can get yourself in trouble. Yeah, I get about 20 of those a day. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Be careful with email addresses, too, because they can put hidden characters in the email address, particularly in links. Let's look at another one. This is purporting to be from Microsoft. From customer support, HalGraham@AOL.com. I don't think Microsoft has Hal Graham send out their emails. The logo is actually correct. Notice it's not addressed to anybody. Dear user, trust me, Microsoft, if they do email you, is going to email you with your username. Your Microsoft email account will be replaced by our new version on February 7th. There is no new version of Microsoft. I have no idea what they're talking about. So please sign in here. Let's look at the link. Does that link look like it's anything from Microsoft? Yeah. It won't hurt you. No, reading an email is not going to, just opening and reading an email is not going to hurt you. Doing anything with that email can. Remember that your ISP, your email provider, is going to scan these before they send them to you. So if there's a virus embedded in the email, you'll never see it. They'll stop it before, most of them will stop it before it gets to you. But once you get it, it's up to you to be sure that you don't fall victim to these guys. These guys, pardon the expression, piss me off because a lot of people don't know. If you get an email that has a link in it like this one does, hover over the link. It will show you where that link is going to take you. Notice that the link is docs.google.com/presentation/blah-blah-blah-blah-blah. Obviously, that's not from Microsoft. And that probably, I didn't click the link, but that email probably takes you, if I had to guess, to a fake Microsoft webpage. Next one. This one's from USAA, reputable company, right? Alexander.Jewell@andersonug.com. Nah. Okay. This is a secure message. Access to this message will expire in 24 hours. Can we make it 2 minutes? Click here by the 5th of February to read your message. After that, open the attachment. So let's look at the link, if I can find the cursor. https://padlet.com, C. Williams 2, USAA, and a bunch of garbledygook. No. No. And then let's look at the link, which is exactly the same thing. So what they're trying to do is get you to click on the links, because either that allows them to install software on your computer, or it takes you to a page that will continue the scam, whatever the scam happens to be. Next one. This is subject. Sportstat, your subscription expired today. Your device was infected with 154 viruses. I got one of these this morning. I now have 176 viruses. My subscription expired, but notice they sent it to that email address. So if my subscription expired, realistically, I'm not going to get it. So that doesn't make any sense. Notice that McAfee down here is spelled wrong. There are always spelling errors in these, and a lot of times it's intentional because it keeps the scanners from recognizing that something is actually not right. Let's look at this link. Storage.googleapis.com and then a bunch of gobbledygook. If it doesn't say Earthlink, it's not Earthlink. Notice that it also comes from hcugs@cesia.whateveritis.com. Trust me, Earthlink emails come from earthlink.net. Next one. Oh, this is one of my favorites. There is so much garbage in this thing. Assistance, please do not reply at abuse-att.net. Abuse.att.net is the address that you use to email AT&T about abusive or scam emails. We at MCF Antivirus, which I assume they're trying to make you think is McAfee, thank you for your assistance. I haven't assisted you with anything. If you need to renew your account, now with a space before the comma, now best offer, notice how many of those words are capitalized, to save more, 50% off, with no space between the percent and no then. Promo the year, 50% save. And then Mick F. down here again at the bottom, and it came from the AT&T Postmaster staff. What does the AT&T Postmaster staff got to do with antivirus? Nothing. Correct. It's also, intervishnia.com is actually in India or Pakistan, I can't remember which. The address that they want you to click on is in India or Pakistan. If you don't recognize the address, if it is an address like this and you don't recognize it, don't click on it. For more information about email best practices and mail delivery issues, visit colon. There's nothing there to visit. There's no link. There's no nothing. This is my all-time favorite. This purports to come from Earthlink, right? It even has the Earthlink logo on it. It's sent to my Earthlink email address, which is Netcom, but it's still an Earthlink email address. My payment has been rejected and my subscription has been closed. Same point. How did I get the email if you've closed my subscription? Credit card declined. Dear subscriber, that might actually be realistic. Notice that card is capitalized. This is one of the ones that actually looks like it might be real. And then you get down here to the link, which is padlet.com, Bobby Bailey, 19-1750, a bunch of gobbledygook. don't think I'll be clicking on this. Number one, my Earthlink subscription is auto-paid, and it gets paid on the 5th of every month on a credit card, so I know when it's paid. So I know this is bogus. But for people who don't remember or don't know how their finances are done, they conceivably can be induced to click on this. And one last one. The annual plan has been auto-renewed, and I don't know whether any of you have seen this. I've gotten about 10 of these in the last 6 months. This one actually came to the church. Ralph got one last week, as a matter of fact. It's from Innocent Kunda, innocentkunda27@gmail, purporting to come from Geek Squad. That is the Geek Squad logo. To undisclosed recipients. Okay, there is an argument that if you don't want everybody to know who you sent the email to, that you actually send it to undisclosed recipients, which most email services will let you do. Subscription receipt, comma. And then there's a picture, and that is actually a JPEG. It is not a generated item. This is total garbage. But notice down here in the corner, you have Best Buy and Geek Squad, and that is their customer support number. What they want you, well, actually, that is not their customer support number, but that's the number they want you to call so that you can renew your subscription. You can get information about renewing your subscription, and the first question it'll ask you is, what's your credit card number? Don't do it. Number one, I don't even have a subscription with Geek Squad, neither does the church. Trojans. Type of malicious code or software that looks legitimate but can take control of your computer. It's designed to damage, disrupt, steal, or in general inflict some other harmful action on your data or network. Trojans are not as common as they used to be, but they are still out there. There are links that if you click on them, they will give the hacker full unfettered access to your computer, and they can do anything to it they want to. They can look at any data they want to. They can download anything off your computer that they want to. And that's not something that you really want them to be able to do. So the scenario is you receive an email from someone you don't know, or maybe appearing to be from someone you do know, asking you to click a link, maybe to view a photo or a video or something like that. What do you do? If the email comes from someone you definitely don't know, don't click it and delete it. If it looks like it comes from somebody you do know, look at the email address. Is it a valid email address for the person sending the email? Same thing we've talked about before, Gordon. Do not click the link. Yeah, do not click the link. So if we go back to one of these, let's go back to that one. Hover over the link and look at what it is. And if it doesn't look right, or in this case, we don't know who sent it, there's no way I'm clicking on that link. Same thing. Hover over the link. Does the link match the text that's shown, or does it look like it's valid? You know, if I hover over a link that says, read more here, and it's an email from, I don't know, let's say Microsoft, and the address goes to Microsoft.com, and it has what looks like a legitimate stub on the end of it, I might click it, but I probably won't. And there's a better way around this anyway. If you answered no to either of the questions, don't click the link and delete the email. Or better yet, email the person who sent it to you or call them and say, did you just send me a link before you click on it? Ralph is famous for sending me emails that don't have a body, they just have a link in them. But I've come to expect it, and I know what he's sending me. It's usually stuff that comes from Russia. Ransomware. This was more prevalent during COVID, too. There were a lot of businesses and a lot of hospitals, even, who were infected with ransomware. It's malicious software that blocks access to your computer that until such time as a sum of money is paid. It is a Trojan. It is installed by clicking a bogus link. What generally happens with ransomware is when you click the link, it installs a little piece of code that encrypts your entire hard drive. Once it starts, you can't stop it. Once it's encrypted, you can't use your computer. So what do you do? Well, let's talk a little more about this. There are ways around, we'll talk about this a little later. There are ways around ransomware as well, but they're not fun and they're not easy. Key is, don't pay the ransom. Spam, the scourge of the internet, the scourge of my life, the scourge of probably most of your lives. First thing to do, turn on your email provider's spam filter. Turn on suspect email blocking if your email provider supports it. Earthlink happens to have a suspect email blocking system. What it says is, if this email comes from someone who is not in my address book, it goes into a separate folder called suspect email. I have to open that folder and look at each email and say, yes, add them to the address book, add them to the address book. This is spam, delete this one. It's a pain in the neck for the first month because a lot of people that you do know will be getting emails back saying, this person has turned on spam blocking. You need to request access to be able to send them emails. You can also handle that yourself by accepting them and putting them in your address book. Spam filters are not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. I get 4 comic strips emailed to me every morning. The people who send me those comic strips are in my address book probably 35 times, and every day it winds up in the spam folder. So always check your spam folder. Some spam emails will get through. You should be able to flag them as spam, and you may or may not see them again. Sometimes the filter works, sometimes it doesn't. You also may be able to block the address, but most providers limit the number of addresses you can block. Earthlink happens to limit it to 500. I think I have 350 or so in mine right now. But check your spam folder regularly. Good example, Mary Lobsher and I exchange emails probably 7 or 8 times a week. And I had sent her a number of things back toward, I guess it was toward the middle of January. And she hadn't seen any of them. And she happened to look in her spam folder, and for some reason the spam filter had sent them all to the spam folder. And they were kind of important, so it would have been good if she'd seen them in real time, but she was really confused because I'd made reference in a later email to something I'd sent in an earlier email that she'd never seen because it was in her spam folder. Be aware, too, that your spam filter is probably automatically emptied at regular intervals. So I check my spam filter every day. First thing I do in the morning is look at what's in my inbox and cull out what I don't want, and then I go look in the spam folder to see what's been put in there that I actually do want to see. So that kind of takes care of the online stuff. Anybody got questions about the online stuff? Marilyn. I don't know how Google and Yahoo do it. I know how Google does it. I do not know how Yahoo does it. There is a button that says this is spam somewhere in the interface that allows you to flag the... You check the box and then say this is spam.
Yeah, they do it in the inbox.
Yeah, you go in the inbox, you have the message there, there's a little box next to it, you check it and mark it spam. And what that will do is it flags for the ISP, the email provider, that this address has been sending spam, and when they see enough of those, eventually they'll block it. What was the second half of the question? I lost my place. Be careful with that. If it's a spam email, all you're doing is confirming that your email address is valid. They send out emails by the millions. They don't always know that the email address they're sending it to is a valid email address. But as soon as you click that unsubscribe button, if they're a scammer, they know. And I guarantee your email address will be on the dark web within about 5 minutes. So be very careful with unsubscribe. If it's a reasonably reputable company, for example, I do sweepstakes with Better Homes and Gardens every day. And every time I do them, it enrolls me in their emails. I don't want their emails. So those I will click unsubscribe, and I go in and unsubscribe from all of them 2 or 3 times a week just to get rid of them. But be careful with unsubscribe because, again, it will flag your email address as a valid email address, and the more of those they can get their hands on, the happier they are. Those are spam. turn your spam filter on. And I don't know, in Yahoo, I don't know how to do it. I haven't looked at Yahoo Mail in probably 20 years. There is a method of turning a spam filter on for every ISP. So figure out, and if you need to, Google turn on spam filter Yahoo, and it'll give you step-by-step directions for how to do it. One computer support point. If you have something you can't figure out how to do, Google it. The chances are 99% that the answer to your question will be either the first or second thing that pops up. Sometimes you won't be able to find it. Sometimes you'll have to go through a whole bunch of stuff and you may not know. But 99 times out of 100, you can find the answer to your question by simply Googling, how do I do this? And it'll give you step-by-step directions for how to do it. Alicia? Yeah. Some people call it spam, some people call it junk. It's the same thing. Anything else on email, online stuff? Okay. Let's put our computers down and pick up our phones and tablets. Text scams. Alicia, would you like to talk about text scams? We have someone here who has actually gone as far as buying the gift cards. Anyway, we'll talk about those in a minute. SMS or text scams generally involve a form of phishing where you receive a text and are asked to purchase something, usually gift cards, and send information to the sender, like the gift card numbers and the pins for those gift cards. Even if the phone number used by the sender looks valid, it probably isn't. It's really easy to spoof a phone number and a name. For example, it's really easy to spoof an email address, too, probably easier than to do this. If you're on session or if you write things for the newsletter, you get an email every month from newsletter@gspcsg.org. I actually send that from my Earthlink account. So it is exceedingly easy to spoof an email address. It's exceedingly easy to spoof a text or to spoof a phone number and caller ID. I got a call, this is about 2 weeks ago, from a name I knew, but from a place that I knew that person didn't live, and from a phone number that I knew wasn't that person's phone number, because it had been spoofed. So be careful with those as well. This is a little exchange that occurred between Eric Westland and a scammer back in early December, and I have copies of it because it's a little hard to read. Purportedly coming from Ralph. Phone number is 501-328-0245. Notice it doesn't say Ralph Klingon because Ralph's in his address book, so in his phone book, so it should be Ralph Klingon. See the plan. The plus one indicates it's the U.S. It's an international one. That's not terribly unusual. There are systems. I get emails from Australia all the time that are plus 42. Hi, Eric. Return my text when you get it. I have a favor to ask Pastor Ralph Klingon. First off, it would just be Ralph. It wouldn't be Pastor Ralph Klingon. Eric says, hey. The other guy says, thanks for your response, Eric. Currently in a meeting. I would have called, but phone call, not calls, aren't allowed in here. I need to get some gift cards today for some women battling cancer in the hospital, but I can't do that right now because of my busy schedule. Can you get it from any nearby store now? I will reimburse you. Thanks. Eric says, anyone I know? I don't think so, Eric. It was a female friend of mine who's also a pastor that requested for it. Period, period, period. Please let me know if you can do this for me as soon as possible. I will surely reimburse you. God bless you. Three eBay cards of $100 denominations, each total $300, is fine. After I purchase, I need you to take off the paper pack placed around the cards to reveal the actual cards, snap or type and send the numbers to Reverend Katrina Hebb at Gmail. Many thanks. Just let me know if you want me to pay back in cash or check. God bless. Eric says, it's Hazel, isn't it? Just because she had an affair with my husband, you can tell me. I'd like to visit with her in the hospital. Guy says, no, not Hazel. What are you talking about? I asked you for a favor, not the other thing you're talking about. Eric says, Wilma? Guy says, enough of this questions. Just let me know if you can do this for me or not. Eric says, that's sort of rude. Will Snerdley's Food Mart have them? I've never bought a gift card before. Guy says, I'm sorry if I was rude. Like I said, I'm in a pastoral meeting and even texting is not allowed. Well, why are you doing it if it's not allowed? You can get them at any nearby store. Thanks for your assistance. God bless you. Eric says, I'm at Snerdley's now, but there are so many kinds. Home Depot, Apple, Gomer's. Guy says, get eBay or Steam gift cards. I think that would be fun. Excuse me. 3 eBay or Steam gift cards of $100 denomination each, total $300 is fine. They don't seem to have those. Should I ask the manager? You can get Apple or iTunes gift cards if they have. Okay, I got 3 Apple cards. I'll leave them for you at reception at the hospital under your name. I already explained to you how you're going to send them, and I didn't mention the hospital to you. Sorry, I missed that. Who's Rev Katrina? I explained to you she's a pastor and a friend also. Please, can you just do me a favor and send the cards to her? God bless you. Forgive me, Ralph, but I just ran into Hazel in the Snerdley's parking lot, and she told me you were not in a meeting, but rather shacked up with her at Motel 6. At Motel 6 all morning. Shame on you again. Guy says, what are you talking about? Enough of this insult. Since you can't get the cards to her, so why the insult? Take care. What do I do with the cards? Send it to me here or follow the instructions. And if you know you can't, then let me know. Eric says, did you get them? I have done this before too, but I've never done it with a text. I've done it with emails where I will sit and just screw with them for hours because it's fun. This is not a good idea. Don't do what he just did. The reason being, phone numbers can be generated randomly because they're just numbers. And a lot of times they will generate a million phone numbers, send a text to all of them, and if anybody replies, they know that's a valid phone number. They may not necessarily know who it is. In this case, they did because they probably got the phone number from one of the newsletters on the website. But if they don't know and they send you a text and you answer that text, now they know that's a valid phone number. And your phone number will also be on the dark web very quickly. Let the person who supposedly sent the text know that you've received the text. And this is critical because if you received it, other people may have received it. And if they know there's something going on, they can let everybody know that there's an issue. Telephone scams. These are my favorites of all time. Telephone scams involve someone calling from a local number, from a company that nearly everybody would recognize, or from a government agency. Screen your calls. I know we were all taught as kids it's impolite not to answer the phone when it rings, but if you don't recognize the number or the caller ID shows a name or location that you don't recognize, don't answer the phone. If the phone call was legitimate, the caller can always leave you a message and you can call them back. But if you answer the phone, you've opened yourself up to spending an extensive period of time on the phone with them, probably, and just getting frustrated, and eventually you'll end up hanging up on them. But the simplest solution is screen your calls. And there are times when I screen my calls a little bit more than that. I will see a name or a number that I do recognize. I don't want to talk to them right now, so I just don't answer the phone, and if they really need me, they'll leave a message. The IRS, Medicare, and Social Security only communicate official information in writing. You will never get a call from the government. Medicare does send notices about claims and notices that your monthly bill is available by email, even though they don't allow you to download your monthly bill, which also annoys me. But the others will never call you. So if you get a call from the IRS, hang up. Yeah, those are really good. Let's talk about public Wi-Fi. Public Wi-Fi may be the most unsafe environment you can possibly attach your phone to. Generally, there's no network security, and what I mean by that is if you have to log into the network like you do here, that's a secure network. Only people on this network are going to be able to read anything that's going on. It allows hackers to monitor and capture information you send to and receive from the internet. And I actually go a step farther. If I'm at a hotel, I frequently do log onto their Wi-Fi, whether it's secure or not. But I also look to see every other device that's on that network. And depending on what I see, I may or may not get off that network really quickly. We're going to talk about VPNs. VPNs are not all they're cracked up to be. What a VPN does, the way a VPN works is you have your computer and there's a server sitting out somewhere, and it creates a tunnel basically from your computer to that server. Theoretically, nobody on the network can actually see your computer if you're on a VPN. That's not entirely true depending on the VPN. But what it does is it encrypts all your traffic from your computer to their server. Then it re-encrypts it and sends it across the internet to another one of their servers that is near where the website or whatever that you're trying to access is located, and then it sends it on to the website. VPNs encrypt your traffic. They disguise your identity. This makes it more difficult for third parties to track your activities online and steal data. More difficult is the operative term. The problem with VPNs is you can't always use them. Most banks will not accept any traffic from a VPN because the scammers can also use a VPN to impersonate where they are. Therefore, they don't want you to do that. They're most useful when you're connecting to a public Wi-Fi or to a public network. I would not use a VPN here. We're on a secure network. I'm not worried about CenturyLink losing my data between here and wherever. If they do, there's nothing much I can do about it. But if I'm in a hotel or a coffee shop or a store using public Wi-Fi, you better bet 99% of the time I'm on a VPN. They also can be used to bypass regional restrictions for streaming services, but it doesn't always work. Good example, I have an ESPN Plus subscription because I want to watch Washington Capitals games on streaming. And they are regionally blacked out, depending on where the game is. What I can usually do is use the VPN to put myself inside their region, and once I do that, I can actually watch the game. But again, it doesn't always work. I tried to watch it was a Caps game the other night. I was in Detroit, I think. And I put myself in the Washington area, and it wouldn't let me do it. And I put myself in the Detroit area, and it wouldn't let me do it. So it may have been even more restrictively blacked out than what I expected. They protect your IP address. Everybody know what an IP address is? An IP address is like your street address on the internet. It is a 12-digit, up to 12-digit address in blocks of three separated by colons. For example, our email address today here is, our IP address today here is 174.23.24.235. Belongs to CenturyLink. All 174 addresses actually belong to CenturyLink. But it also tells people where you are. So you don't really want your IP address out there. The problem with VPNs is that most websites don't allow you to connect if you're on a VPN. Most financial sites don't allow you to because, again, they don't want the hackers to be able to spoof locations and then log into their network. So they're great for general use. There are some things they don't work with. They're free VPNs. They're paid VPNs. And some antivirus and security software includes them. Norton 360 includes one, I think LastPass has a VPN, actually. Some of the others do. Most of the free VPNs are not very secure. They're okay. They're not great. Paid VPNs are not very expensive, usually. They're $4 or $5 a month, less with an annual subscription, and they have a lot more features. For example, I use NordVPN, and I can literally tell it to connect to three VPNs, three different servers between my address and where it's going. which anonymizes it once, anonymizes it twice, anonymizes it a third time, and anonymizes it the fourth time. I don't do that, but I could. It's got some other features that are really good. But again, if the people you're connecting to won't let you use it, it isn't really all that valuable. Let's talk about Apple's private servers, which everybody thinks are VPNs, iCloud private servers. They're not. I look at our website traffic every day, and I see a lot of stuff from iCloud private server, and I see the actual IP address, and I see the location for every single one of them. So all it does is it strips off some of the information, like what browser you're using, how you're connected to the internet. There are a couple of things it strips out, but it is not a VPN. It's a sort of anonymizer, if you will. So that covers, we got through that in 55 minutes. I'm amazed. That covers everything I wanted to talk about. I am happy to take any other questions you have. Yes, sir. I love the Nigerians. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Now, the Nigerians are notorious for this. There are some people in Kenya who like to do this. There are a few in China. I've seen a couple come out of China, and their English is always really interesting. But most of them, believe it or not, actually come out of the U.S. and Europe, because they know how to communicate with people in native languages that they can get them, they can manipulate them and get them to do things. So as I say, if you see something that looks too good to be true, it is. It is. Better to be safe than sorry, particularly with clicking links. As I say, I get links all the time, but 99 times out of 100, they're coming from someone I know. I have a reasonable idea of what it is I'm getting. Ralph loves to forward Sergey's emails to me, which are all in Russian, and usually have a link in them because Sergey doesn't email photos. He puts them on a server in Russia, and we have to go get them, which is fine for videos because they're long and you can't really email them. But for photos, just attach them. It's easier. You will run up against the 20 meg limit for most emails, but that's not a big deal anymore. So, Marilyn. What kind of computer do you have? Windows or Mac? Windows or Mac? Windows or Mac? Windows Defender is fine. You do not need additional antivirus software on a Windows machine. I don't know what Apple does for AV on their phones. I know Android doesn't actually do anything. So I do have antivirus on my phone and my tablet, but I do not have it on my computer because Windows Defender does a perfectly good job of protecting you. To be honest, most internet service providers actually protect you before it ever gets to your computer. What you want to be sure of is that the link, the file that you open or the website that you open doesn't have something embedded in it that's going to be a virus or whatever. We're back to the Trojan thing again. By and large, the ISPs do a pretty good job of screening those out before they ever get to you. But you do want antivirus software that's going to look and say, okay, there's a virus embedded in this. I'm not going to let you open it. Sometimes Windows Defender will oftentimes pop up a message and say, hey, this is really suspect. This is why it's suspect. You can say get out of here, or you can say accept the risk and go on. If I know for a fact that where I'm going is legitimate and I know for a fact that what I'm trying to do is legitimate, I just go on. I don't worry about it. But if I get something from somebody that I don't recognize, then I'll take their hint and I'll go look at the security certificates and things like that and say, hey, is this legit? And if it's something I really need to or really want to do, then I may do it. But 99 times out of 100, I just dump it and get out of here. Ann? Yeah, no, that's how Apple handles it. It's handled pretty much the same way in all the antiviruses. I've forgotten who actually is the basis of Windows Defender. I want to say it's Norton, but I may be wrong. I'm not sure. I think actually Windows Defender is now Windows Defender. I think Microsoft redid it. But in the old days, most of the operating system antivirus was a commercial antivirus that was modified to run in the operating system. So Windows Defender, or what used to be called Windows Antivirus, I think, or Microsoft Antivirus, was actually an offshoot of Norton. I've been using Norton Utilities since the 80s. They were really good back when they were small enough that they didn't eat your machine, but they are so huge and so resource intensive, and that's not as big a problem now as it used to be, that they can actually slow your machine down to the point that you can't work with it. So be careful of commercial antivirus products that promise all things to all people, because they will frequently do things, one, that you don't need them to do. Most of them do a lot more than you need them to do. And they will, in fact, sometimes slow your machine down. Best thing in the world for any of you who don't have it but have it available is CenturyLink fiber internet. I get about 840 megabits per second on mine for $65 a month on average. Yeah, you guys are on fiber in Sun River. Any other questions? Alicia. We didn't talk about it, but I also have an ad blocker on all of my browsers, and I also have a script blocker on all of my browsers. What an ad blocker does is it says, okay, if there is something displayed on the web page that I know is an ad, it won't display it. So I don't get bombarded by crap, and I don't have to sit and watch it load ads for a half an hour before I can do what I need to do. A script blocker, every website you use, including ours, has scripts built into it to display things. What a script blocker does is it blocks those scripts from running. They're really good for most websites, but you will every now and then encounter a website that won't work without scripts. Instagram happens to be one of those. You cannot run a script blocker and run Instagram because it will not work. Everything that it does is a script. So feel free to install a script blocker and turn it on, and if the website doesn't work, just turn it off for that website. But they do make it more secure, because 90% of the scams and 90% of the Trojans and 90% of the malware is in the form of a script. So if the script can't run, it can't infect your computer. I say can't. Probably can't. Let's be careful. There is no absolute in any of this. It's like I said, there's no way to be 100% secure online. There's no way for all of these tools to work 100% of the time. Ultimately, it's on you to be sure that you're safe online. Alicia. There are two different kinds of signing in to their Wi-Fi. If you sign in from a pop-up that says you need to sign in, like you have to here, that is signing into the Wi-Fi. If you simply have to open a web page, agree to terms, and put in your email address and say accept, that is not signing into the Wi-Fi. No, that's just acknowledging that you've accepted their terms and conditions. The hospital's secure. Yeah, the hospital's secure. Because you have to log in with your room, as I recall, your room number and create a password. Yeah, but even if you're a visitor, all right. Networks are a little bit different. There are multiple networks at the hospital. There is their administrative network. There is the patient network, and there is a guest network. The guest network is not secure. I have a guest network at home for anybody, for the one person a year who walks into my house other than me and the cats. They can log into the guest network. They can't get to anything else on the network, and it's not secure. But it's there to give them internet access from within my house on Wi-Fi. Anybody else? And I'm always available to answer questions if you have a question. Kathy and John and I were talking a little earlier. I have a couple of people who call me about once every 5 or 6 days wanting help with their computer. And, you know, if you call me once every 3 or 4 months or ask me a question, I'll be happy to answer it. Don't call me every 3 or 4 days. I'm not your free computer support person. I'll be happy to help when I can, but I'm not going to take time out of my day to stop and solve problems for you. That, as I say, if you don't know how to do something, Google it. It works. In fact, I had to Google something this morning because I couldn't remember how to do it. I do it all the time. Okay.